Yes. Okay, I want to start by answering a question. Are they in here? Who asked about census taking? They're not here. You're here, right. Okay.
No, it wasn't me. It was Steve. Or,
Steve, he was sitting here earlier.
Yeah.
Right. Oh. Okay, so maybe I won't answer that question then. So if it's not your question, I'll let Rabbi Levin answer next week. Okay, next week there's not a class, right?
Really?
It's the week after. Next week is President's Weekend.
Oh.
So I'm pretty sure, according to my schedule, there's not.
Yeah, well, that's...
if there is, then...
No, I guess I don't.
I'm sure we'll be
teaching it. I don't know that we have a schedule for this year. Did you get one? Oh, I don't have that.
We should double check. But
oh, it's right here, right? February 6th, 13th, and 27th.
Class next week. The following week.
Ah, I can sleep in.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Not.
We trailed off kind of in the middle. I'm not exactly sure where we got to. Who has their notes who can tell me what we got up to? We did the five pillars, right?
We didn't do the last one. We got to Hajj, but we didn't get to prayer.
Okay, so the five pillars, basically. So we're talking about the rise of Islam. And why? Because we need to understand Judaism in the context of Islam. Obviously, Islam has affected us a lot. We don't think of it necessarily today, although it will influence our understanding of politics today. But it's very important to understand how Islam and the rise of Islam affected Jewish philosophy, and it did. So that's why we're going into it a little bit, and then we'll bring it back to Jewish. Somebody gave me a quizzical look when I was reading the Quran over Shabbos. I'm like, what are you doing? So I'm preparing for my history class, teaching Rise of Islam. They're like, it's a Jewish history class, and you're teaching Rise of Islam? Why? But it is actually very important to understand. Okay, so five pillars of Islam, then. We talked about one God and Muhammad. That's their statement of faith. That's how you convert to Islam. All you have to do is say that three times. You know, there is one God, and Muhammad is his prophet. That's it. Right?
And then you're Islamic?
And then you're Muslim. Wow. One thing I think I didn't mention last time, I just wanted to point out, in the olden days, the Muslims were called Mohammedans, right? Like we were called, what were we called? We were called the Mosaic faith, or I don't know if we were never called Mosesians, whatever. But they were called Mohammedans. They don't like that because they're not Mohammedans. They're Muslims. And that's their name of preference, because Mohammedan, coming from a Western point of view, means they're followers of Muhammad. So they're followers of God, and Muhammad is his prophet. They don't want to be seen, like, for instance, I mean, that really, I think, comes from the Christian paradigm, Christians following Christ, right? Mm-hmm. So they would then call the followers of Muhammad Mohammedans, whereas the followers of Muhammad really are... they're Godites with Muhammad as the last prophet. That's their philosophy. So they see themselves as Muslims. So the name of the religion is Islam. The name of a follower is a Muslim. Muslim is a passive form in Arabic or in Hebrew of, it means submitter. So there is a root peace, which is harped on quite a bit by the American government. Religion of peace, religion of peace, religion of peace. You can do your own study and find out that it's not quite... or at all. And did anybody get to hear the son of Hamas speak? I know you were there. Anybody else there at the Alliance last week? Very interesting. The son of a founder of Hamas spoke. He's converted to Christianity. So it was just interesting to hear him speak about philosophies of Hamas, of Islam, and as a Palestinian raised in the West Bank, son of a Hamas leader who spent time in prisons, and then through that converted to Christianity, now asserts that the whole Muslim problem is that they're prisoners of Allah and Islam.
And how can he change that?
So he's speaking out. How is he still alive? God should protect him. Mm-hmm. But how can he change that? By bringing a message to more people and by trying to let people see that there is a difference. It's not a religion of peace. Mm-hmm. That the actual followers of it are trapped in it. Mm-hmm. So, it's interesting. Anyway. Okay, so, pillar one, God and Muhammad. Pillar two, fasting. That's the 30 days of fasting for Ramadan. Pillar three, charity. 2.5% of all your assets per year. Pillar four, Hajj, making that a pilgrimage at least once in your life to Mecca to walk around the Kaaba stone and follow the route of Abraham in his offering up of Ishmael as the offering before God, according to their philosophy. I see a physical face. You weren't here last week, right?
No, I didn't know it was in Mecca.
According to Islam, it was on the Kaaba stone. That was the stone upon which Ishmael was offered to God. And according to Jewish belief, of course, it was on the stone that's the rock that's under the dome of the rock on the Temple Mount. That's the place where Isaac was offered.
Right.
Great. Okay, and the fifth being prayer 5 times a day. We've all seen that, heard that call to prayer. It's usually lay-led prayer, but, you know, somebody chosen lay leadership. So a leader from the laity is the one who makes the call to prayer. Most of what we hear today when we're in Israel is recorded. It's just a recorded call that they send out over a microphone system. But in the olden days, so it would just be somebody with a strong voice who could project, who would stand on the top of the minaret and call people to prayer 5 times a day. Men, women, children, as soon as they're old enough, it's 5 times a day towards Mecca. The towards Mecca concept, and if you look in some hotels, I think I've only seen it once, some hotels in this country have stickers on the window that say which way is Mecca.
Wow.
It's a thing they're trying to do. Gideon's Bibles and Mecca stickers. You know, really. It's because of the Gideon's Bible that the Muslims are trying to get Mecca stickers in the hotel rooms so that everybody will know what's the right direction for prayer. We Jews, it's funny, we don't really use it. I mean, you can pray. You want to pray towards Jerusalem, of course, but if you don't know exactly, so it's east. Outside of Israel, it's just east. You can usually tell by the sun. How it's rising, what's east, and then you just pray in the east direction. but there is a Jerusalem compass that you can buy, which you can just hold, and it'll point to Jerusalem wherever you are, so that you'll know which way is Jerusalem.
The Gideon Bible, is that Christian?
Yes, it's Christian.
Okay. So they want to put stickers because they say, hey, you got a Christian Bible?
Yeah. You hotels, places where people travel, are supporting Christianity by allowing the Gideons to purchase Bibles, not purchased by the hotels. By allowing the Gideons to purchase Bibles and place them, de rigueur, in all your hotel rooms. So we want the same treatment. You know, we're also a religious group that we want our travelers to feel comfortable.
Okay.
So it's not really because so many Muslims are traveling and they all need to know the direction of Mecca. It's because they want a presence felt. It's because there is a campaign among Muslims. They're smart. They're working hard on creating acceptance and working through the system instead of against the system, in this country anyway. So that's a way to work with the system. Oh, you have a system where you, in travel places, recognize that religion might be important to somebody on their way. Well, we're also a religion. We also want that recognition. How about putting up one of our Mecca stickers?
Okay.
Yeah, so anyway, it's not as accepted yet. It's not as universal as the Gideon Bibles, but that's a thing. Okay, so those are their pillars. That's considered the pillars of Islam. I did bring, if anybody wants to borrow this for these 2 weeks, Houston Smith's World Religions Illustrated, with very pleasant chapters on each of the major religions. It's all from a very positive point of view. There's no anything negative about anybody. It's just like what each religion has to offer to its followers. So if anybody wants to borrow that, you can. I also brought in my, it's really heavy, Quran from CARE, the Council on Arab-Islamic Relations, who's doing their own missionary work, and will send you one of these for free. I think now they charge postage because they just don't want you just getting it free. It's heavy, so I'm sure the postage is $10. But it's interesting because it is, it's kind of like an art scroll.
Mm-hmm.
It's got your Arabic, your English, your transliterated Arabic,
wow,
so that you don't have to be able to read the letters themselves, and then commentary, translated by a Jew, just so you know, who converted to Islam.
Is that how you got it?
I got it because
of... You ordered it.
I got it. I'm on tape here. I got it because back in the old days of Jews for Jesus, when they were really proselytizing, so we signed up for everything. They should send us everything. A, so we could learn from it, but B, so we could just be a piece in draining their resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they'll send to us, so they're not going to send. It's one less thing to mail out to somebody who's vulnerable. So we want to be on the list. So once we saw CARE was offering Qurans for free, we thought if they'll send to us, it's one less other person. So we ordered two. So we have two of these. So I think that's why they charge postage now, just so you shouldn't just sign up for free and just have them sent out. This is an expensive book. I'm sure this is like a $75 book. It's a coffee table book. But anyway, and it's very heavy. But anybody who wants to borrow it over the break, have my one home for reference, you're welcome to borrow this one. And you can order it. It has it stamped on the side, CARE, with the website, so you can go on the website and you can order one. So you can have your very own. And it is interesting. It has interesting stuff. And I mean, it's interesting to read, you know, what their some of their understandings are. And then you can look things up, too. I did find something to read. Let's see if we get to that.
Did they try to follow the five books of Moses, or did they just...
Oh, so that's where I got stopped. Okay, so the whole point of praying towards Mecca is because the Jews have a concept of praying towards Jerusalem.
Right.
So they first prayed towards Jerusalem, and then when the Jews didn't buy in, so they switched it to Mecca. So do they follow the five books of Moses? No. They believe that Muhammad being the last prophet, and I read much more about it over the week, so in their mind, other nations received prophets. No prophet ever arose from the Arab nations because it was waiting, God was waiting for the ultimate final prophet, Muhammad, to be the one who would arise from those nations. And if any other prophet would have ever arisen from the Arab nations, then the final prophet wouldn't have been able to actually have the final say, because people would think that he's following his people in the footsteps of the previous prophets, which is why prophets only arose in other nations. But the final prophet, Muhammad, arose in the among the Arabs so that he could testify to the Arabs who needed it, but also to be the final arbiter of God's word. So what the Muslims believe is God picked the Jews from among the nations, revealed his Torah to them, and then the Jews dropped the ball, completely lost the Torah, bastardized it along the way, and the Christians picked up pieces of it. Jesus was a prophet. The Christians bastardized it. There's no such thing as a Trinity, and it says it very clearly in the Quran. Anybody who believes that Jesus is that God is the son of a woman is, you know, problematic. I'll see if I get to that. And that God is one of three, also unbelievers going to burn in hell. But that God is one, so that's good. The Jews believe God is one, that's good, except for they're miserable people and they don't actually do what they're supposed to. That's just part of their, that's what it says. It's just part of their philosophy, but there turns out that their believers were unbelievers. As
they
group.
Talk about Jews.
Yeah, the Jews are believers who are unbelievers. I mean, their philosophy is a believer philosophy, but as a people, they're unbelievers. Mm-hmm. The Christians are believers, they just believe the wrong thing. So they're basically, they believe in God, which the Muslims appreciate, but with the whole Trinity thing, mm-hmm. bad news. So they're against that. But at least they're more faithful to their faith, according to Islam. Meanwhile, what the world was waiting for was a final prophet, Muhammad, to come and say the actual revelation is this, is the Quran. So what was given on Mount Sinai was lost. It had to be re-revealed. So it's not that he has to follow the five books of Moses. That's, in the Muslims' opinion, that's a bastardization of what was actually revealed. The true revelation is in the Quran. So that, and that's the explanation for any discrepancies. Of course there's discrepancies. You guys lost it. We have the real thing. So that's what the Quran is in Muslim eyes. The real thing that was finally given with clarity to Muhammad in six something, early sixes. Early 600. Okay. Prayer. Okay, so now Muhammad did what many leaders do foolishly, which is die without having appointed a successor. So then there was a battle over who's going to be his successor, his father-in-law or his son-in-law. I guess he didn't have sons, right? So there wasn't a son for it, so his son-in-law or father-in-law. Many fathers-in-law, many sons-in-law, but each, there were two important ones. Right, so they're the ones who competed. Where are mine?
Okay. He had a brother as well.
If he did, that wasn't part of the big contention. I mean, he might have, but that wasn't. The two main camps go after father-in-law, son-in-law. Now, I hope I don't confuse you by this, but I'll just tell you my mnemonic. Sunni sounds like sun. And since Islam is wrong, it's wrong to think that it's the son that made the Sunni. It's the father-in-law that's the Sunni. And so, and it's the son-in-law that's Shiite, right? So the Shiites come from the son-in-law, the father-in-law formed the Sunni. So the two main branches of Islam diverge right after the death of Muhammad. So when Muhammad dies, son-in-law and father-in-law fight and create the two separate branches right there on the spot. So the followers of the father-in-law are the Sunnis, and the follower of the son-in-law are the Shiites. The, let's see, Sunnis, father of the founders of the followers of the father-in-law. It's the largest branch of Islam, and that is the Orthodox version. That's what we see mostly in the news, is the Sunni branch, and the Shia branch is the followers. It really, the whole thing is Shiatu Ali, followers of Ali, who's the son-in-law. Those are the Shias, and that is the smaller school. Both of them have different hadiths. I think we used that word last week, right? Hadith is the oral tradition. So Sharia, we talked about these words, right? So Quran, the book, Surah, the chapters of the book, that's how you refer to it. It's what number Surah and then a verse in the Surah. Hadith is the oral tradition that interprets it. And Sharia is law. So that's your Muslim vocabulary. So they lahavdil, meaning not like, but like us, have an oral law to interpret their written law. Right? So the Shias and the Sunnis have two separate oral traditions because they didn't need really the oral tradition after, you know, when Muhammad was alive, because he is the one who got to say everything. So the oral tradition developed separately in those two camps, and neither group accepts the other's oral traditions. So that is part of that's the foundation of the divergence of the two groups, is separate. So they both agree on the same Quran, but they diverge over the oral interpretation thereof.
Are they very different?
Apparently, they're very different. And apparently, I heard on NPR, I'm so glad they weren't profiling kosher food, because they were profiling halal food and saying that the sectarian differences in whatever country they were talking about have come down to chicken. Sunnis won't eat the Masra chicken, and Shias won't eat the Hamadi chicken, and everybody has their own halal standards and their own halal chickens, and groups won't eat from each other. So I'm thinking, if they profile the Jews, we have so many different kosher standards. Thank God they stayed out of our backyard. Anyway, so they are very different, and they don't hold by each other at all, and they'll kill each other. The other one's wrong, completely wrong. And, yeah.
In terms of Sharia, is that similar between the two, or do they differ on the...
I'm sure there are similarities, but they don't hold by one code. It's not like they have a Shulchan Aruch. It's not like the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim that share concepts at all. It's not like that at all. It's two completely separate sects. It's more, in a way, like the Catholics and the Protestants. But it's not, even, because the Protestants broke away from the Catholics. This is two groups. You have the center and two groups that developed into their own separate streams, so they're not breakaways from each other. It really started at the beginning, the founding of Islam, and so they developed separate philosophies and streams. It's important to understand some of the aspects of the mindset of the Arabs that went into that. I mean, they were a feuding people. They were a tribal people. They were people, in a way, kind of like the American Indians, where they had their own internal philosophies, many of which different tribes shared. But they were tribes, and they killed each other and enslaved each other and were brutal to each other. Some tribes got along, and some tribes totally did not. So this country, I mean, we just think of pilgrims and Indians as one group. You know, that's not the way. If you study anything about American Indian history, about both Americas' Indian history, widely different philosophies among many different tribes. So the same thing in Arabia, many different tribes with many different philosophies, but some of the things that they shared were war, that they fought each other, that they wanted conquest of each other, that they would enslave each other. And animism as a basis for religion, so paganistic, animistic in different flavors, but the foundation was pagan. Multiple gods and animal worship and witchcrafty things and voodoo-y type of things.
And that was
us? No.
Or was that before?
Before.
Okay.
Before. So Muhammad felt very strongly that he was coming to clean that up and testify about the one God to the Arabs. So at first he was rejected. The Kaaba stone, that's now a central part, you know, it's the center of the mosque at Mecca, that was a pagan shrine. So it was a place, I discussed last week, how Mecca was a place of pilgrimage and people came there. There was a whole industry built around it. So he just flipped that into the stone of the one God. So he explained that the reason why people were so attracted to that stone is because, not that he's new, he's not bringing a new message, he's just bringing you the true message. That stone is attractive because it is a holy stone. That's the one upon which our father, all of our father, Abraham, offered his son Isaac, our great-grandfather. Right? So, Ishmael. Yeah, thank you. Ishmael. Right? So that he went back to Abraham and then traced the lineage through Ishmael. Right? Right. So, and that stone, that's why that stone's valuable. So he was able to not necessarily, I mean, he was smart, sort of like the Christians or the Catholics as they evolved through Europe, taking in pagan things, but he didn't allow it to remain pagan. He just reinterpreted it. So what he took in was the specialness of the stone and its specialness, and just flipped that into monotheistic specialness. So it's not the stone that's worshipped, but, you know, the event that happened there was special.
What research I did, that they were pagan, multiple worship of many gods, and the moon god elevated himself amongst and subdued all the other gods, and that became, you know, faith in Allah. That's why their symbol is crescent moon, because it's the worship of a moon god.
Interesting.
It's still paganism that just deceive, you know, their minds, thinking that it's monotheistic. It's pagan.
It's not pagan. It's not pagan. I mean, that's. It may be that they flipped that symbol too, but I mean, the Jewish philosophers agree that Islam is a monotheistic, non-pagan religion.
It's the worship of a moon god.
It's not the worship of a moon god. It's not. It's not. Maybe they chose that symbol, but it's not. I mean, Rambam refers to Muhammad as the crazy one, Hamashuga. That's how he's referred to. However, Rambam writes about the purpose of Christianity and Islam in the world. I mean, he asks a question that any Jew has to ask. What's with the strength of these two religions? Why did they spread so far and so wide? Why was their reach so deep? So his answer is to spread the word of the one God. God's work is done in the hands of many, not just the Jews. So the concept of one God was spread through the sword by Islam and through the sword and convincing by Christianity, so that today on this planet, most people have heard about the one God of the Jews, who's also the God of the Christians, who's also the God of the Muslims. Even if they're not adherents of the one God in some way, they've heard of it. So, and that, he says, that's really the function of those two big religions, is spreading the one God concept.
The concept.
Just the one godness of it. And then there's other things to fill in, but at least what they did was prime humanity to hear the Jewish message later. But the one godness, the one God concept was spread through their hands, according to the Rambam. Who had a question? Somebody was... No? Yeah?
The Jews, they weren't into assimilating other cultures as well, right? They, you know, they were like, this is us and that's them. They can listen, but they're not part of us.
Right.
Or
right.
It's like Christianity, they like to convert. That's
right.
Like their goal.
Yes.
And Islam,
also.
Same thing.
Yes.
So, I mean, they may have spread just based on the fact that
they're converting religions.
Taking in everybody, and the Jews were.
Right, right. Well, so a few different things. Jews don't proselytize in general. There was a little proselytizing done in biblical times, but in general, Jews are not proselytizers because we're authentic, because we're bearing a real message, because we only want soldiers who are willing to actually fight our battle. So we're not about increasing our numbers just so that we have big numbers. We're about being authentic messengers of God. And if anybody wants to join us, fine, but you have to be authentic about it. So you can't proselytize for that. And you can't try to convince people. People have to be convinced on their own and come in. So, and that's why we set the bar high for conversions. It's not easy to convert. You have to really be willing to take the whole package and bear it. And, you know, be a trooper along with it. It's a big deal to be a Jew. Whereas for the and another extremely important factor, that's one. The other extremely important difference about the proselytizing and why the difference between the other two is we don't believe, we're not an exclusive religion. We don't believe that if you're not Jewish, you're damned to hell. We believe that Gentiles can create their own relationship with God, that's the relationship they're destined to live in, and that it's fine. So you don't have to become Jewish to realize your destiny or to be the best person you can be. A Jew has to be Jewish to be the best person you can be. But a Gentile doesn't. A Gentile can be their best self as a Gentile. That is not the case with Christianity and Islam worldview. In order to be the best you can be, you have to be theirs. And so for Christians, if you're not saved, you're going to hell, no matter who you are, right? Even if you're a Jew and you believe in the one God, if you don't believe in Jesus as your Lord and Savior, you're going to hell. You're going to burn forever, which is a problem with, let's say, babies who are born unbaptized. That's why Catholics will save the baby over the mother, because the mother's already baptized. She's going to heaven. But if the baby dies before they're baptized, either hell or limbo. It's limbo, really, for babies that are born that didn't sin but didn't get saved. So better they should let the mom die, save the baby. Save the baby and then save the baby so the baby can now go to heaven. Anyway, so that's Christian philosophy in the broadest sense. And Muslim philosophy is, if you're not a Muslim, then you're going to hell unless you believe in one God. So Christians and Jews don't have to be converted as long as they understand clearly that they are, here's one of your other vocabulary words, dhimmis, or however you pronounce that, D-H-I-M-M-I, spelled in some different ways, dhimmi, dhimmi. As long as you understand that you are second-class status, that the Muslims and their God, their version of God, rule the earth, and it's actually the true version, just you don't feel like being that, fine. If you're a Christian or a Jew, you're a person of the book, you can stay that way. As long as you don't physically be higher than a, you have to take, you're not allowed to physically be higher than a Muslim, so you have to walk lower than them. Walk on the curb if they're walking next to you. Bend your knees if you're tall. Not allowed to be higher. Not allowed to build anything higher, which is why the old shuls in the old city of Jerusalem, when it was under Muslim rule, they're subterranean because they had to be lower than any mosque. And what else? And you had to pay a tax and be humiliated. So there was a tax on the Jews in general, paid towards the caliph, and then the head of the Jewish community, the top, whoever it was, would have to go and bring the tax to the head of the Muslim community and be publicly slapped. Just, I mean, not for the pain, but for the humiliation. They had to be publicly humiliated as they offered the tax, just to make it very clear that Jews are second class. So, and I imagine the same thing was true for Christians, and I just don't know for sure, but for sure that's the way the Jews were treated. So, but the rest of the world is going to hell, unless they're saved by the sword. So that's why I put on here, did I, on yours? Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Harb. These are the two realms. So we Jews divide the world into Jew and Gentile. Just like the Mormons, there's Mormons and Gentiles. My husband gave a talk to a bunch of Mormon college students, and as he on Judaism. So as the person was taking him to the place where he was going to give the talk, so my husband has said, "Will I be the only Gentile in the room?" Because it's all Mormons. Turns out no, because my husband's a Levi, so he's not technically a Gentile, even according to the Mormons. He's a priest. He's from the priestly caste. But anyway.
It's not good.
People who are not Levites or Kohens would be Gentiles to the Mormons. Okay, so we divide the world, Jew-Gentile. They divide it Mormon-Gentile. The Muslims divide it, believers-unbelievers. But the territory is divided into Dar al-Islam, Dar el-Harb. Dar is a Semitic language, so if you speak any Hebrew, same root as the word dira, apartment, dwelling place. The dwelling place of Islam, the dwelling place of Harb, Harav, sword. So the world is divided into that which is Islamic and that which is under the sword, meaning that which needs to be compelled to become Islamic through the sword. And they make no bones about it. Those are the two realms of the world. So America, Dar el-Harb, because we are not Dar el-Islam. Right? So Egypt, Dar el-Islam. America, Dar el-Harb.
Isn't the problem that Christians and Jews are called infidels on a regular basis?
Mm-hmm. Only if they're not really doing it. They're not infidels. Like, their philosophy is fidel. It's just that the Christians and the Jews are constantly straying, which is why they needed Muhammad. You know, he needed one last. Because, see, the Jews had many prophets, he says here. Let's see if I can find that. Had many prophets. Oh, so this is straight up from the Quran, right? Indeed, we accepted a solemn pledge from the children of Israel, we God, and we sent apostles unto them. But every time an apostle came unto them with anything that was not to their liking, they rebelled. To some of them they gave the lie, while to others they would slay, thinking that no harm would befall them, and so they became blind and deaf of heart. Thereafter God accepted their repentance, and again many of them became blind and deaf. But God sees all that they do. Indeed, the truth deny they who say, behold, God is the Christ. So that's the Jews. Now, to the Christians. The truth deny they who say, behold, God is the Christ, son of Mary, seeing that the Christ himself said, O children of Israel, worship God alone, who is my sustainer as well as your sustainer. Behold, whoever ascribes divinity to any being beside God, unto him will God deny paradise, and his goal shall be the fire, and such evildoers will have none to succor them. Indeed, the truth deny they who say, behold, God is a third of the Trinity, seeing that there is no deity whatever save the one God. And unless they desist from this, their assertion grievous suffering is bound to befall such of them as are bent on denying the truth. Will they not then turn towards God in repentance and ask his forgiveness? For God is much forgiving, a dispenser of grace. The Christ, son of Mary, was but an apostle. All other apostles had passed away before him, and his mother was one who never deviated from the truth, and they both ate food like other mortals. Behold, how clear we make these messages unto them, and behold, how perverted are their minds. Say, would you worship beside God aught that has no power either to harm or to benefit you, when God alone is all-hearing, all-knowing? So, anyway, the Jews got the message. Don't listen. Even though God sent tons of prophets to them, they still reject it. They lie, they kill the prophets, so they have the right message, they just don't do it. That's the Jews. Christians have most of the message, except for they're messed up with the Trinity thing. So they just have to repent, but anybody who doesn't will burn. So
was the Quran first written in Arabic or Hebrew?
Arabic. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Do you have any copies of that second page?
The second page should be in the back of here.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. One more time. How is America Dar el-Harb?
America is Dar el-Harb because we're not a Muslim country. Mm-hmm. So we're clearly living under the sword and the necessity of Muslims to conquer us. The world for Muslims is divided into already Muslim and not yet Muslim.
Muslim to be.
Mm-hmm. And the method of to be is the sword. Right. Mm. So you could be persuaded, maybe, but really the sword is the method. That's why they call it the world of Islam, the world of the sword. Mm. Not the world of needs to be convinced still. It's not about convincing, it's about sword. Mm-hmm. So that's their language, just so you understand. We live under the sword of Islam. They're waiting to conquer us by the sword. That is their philosophy. Okay. All right, moving down, because we do have lots to still talk about today. Jihad. Jihad is a concept in Islam, is a double concept. It is the fight against evil, the fight against that which assaults faith. That's really the best way probably to translate it. The fight against that which assaults faith. So, particularly, and I didn't study really Sufi Islam, but I think particularly in Sufi Islam and in other branches of Islam, as a sub-theme, jihad is the fight against your own evil inclination. So it's the internal fight. So jihad is used for the word of that which assaults your faith inside. The fight against your yetzer hara is called jihad. So that is definition two of jihad. But definition one of jihad is the fight against everybody else on the planet who assaults their faith. That's what jihad is. The fight against those who would assault the faith. So that's us, and that's everybody else that doesn't want to be a Muslim. So that's what jihad is about, the fight against them, the conquering of the true faith over everything else. That's what jihad is. Okay, enough of that, unless you have more questions on that for now.
Who came up with jihad? It's part of the Quran
ideology? I think so.
If
I'm not an expert in Islam. Sorry. I don't know exactly where the concept came from, but it is a strong concept. We hear about it a lot. So I just want to make sure that the word is understood. And those two ways, those are the main ways that it's used in Islam. Definition one and definition two, both. So you will hear Muslim apologists say, no, jihad's not about fighting you. It's about the internal struggle. And it's true. It is about the internal struggle. And it's about fighting you. You just have to know. Okay, so in order to understand now some of the influence that Islam brought to the Jews, I have to understand a drop more. So that concept, the jihad, the fight, that they got that from the Jews. Now, what did they give us? One of the things that they gave us was words. They're very into words and language. The whole Arabic culture is into that. Very much into using words, and lots of them. So, for instance, part of the Arab culture, whether it's Islamic or not, but part of the Arab culture is bargaining, right? When you go to the shuk, you can't just buy something at the price. Maybe sometimes today you can if you just buy the exorbitant price. But you have to engage in a give and take. Right? They say a price, you say a price. It's not about bargaining like it is in Greece when you go to the market there. That's about handling to figure out the price. This is about using words to engage in a relationship. So it's important to understand that's what's underlying it. Words are very important to the Arabs. So, in handling, very important, it's about relationship. And then in everything else that they do. So, in their history, even in modern history, that's why this is an important concept to get, they like words. So, for instance, in this, wasn't the Six-Day War, in the Yom Kippur War, maybe it was the Six-Day War, sorry about my history as a week here, when we were conquering them, so that was the Six-Day War, right, when we attacked them, they suffered losses. While they were suffering the losses, while they were being defeated, they had news broadcasts that said their soldiers were marching from Suez into Tel Aviv. Language. Yeah. What they say is really important to them. What they do does not have to match.
What they say.
You have to know that about that culture.
Right.
So Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic, two different things. What Arabs will say to you in English, what Arabs will say to their own people in two different things, because language is a thing for them. And how they use language, very important. We have this thing about truth. We're not always the best at it, but we have a thing about it, which means, I think one of the small differences is, look at the Jews, such a smart people, and we're so stupid when it comes to properly propagandizing ourselves, even just letting people know what is Israel, what are Jews, what are our contributions to the world. Nobody really knows, right? Because we don't talk about it. I mean, we're the whole Madison Avenue and we can't figure out how to make Israel look good, right? But they know, they understand words, and they know how to propagandize against and how to put out words against. Very into words. So words manifest today in that sense politically, but words at that time also extremely important. Their histories were important, and verbose and poetry. Very important. And their writing, also, very beautiful. Just so you know, anybody who reads Hebrew, right, we know that we have 22 letters and six final letters, right? Arabic has, I think, also 22 letters, but they have a beginning, a middle, and an ending form for each letter. So depending on where the letter is in the word, if it's the beginning of the word, the middle of the word, or the end of the word, it's a different shape. So you have to learn all those shapes, and that's what gives way to the script and the prettiness of it, and they're into the prettiness of their letters and the art of their letters, but also the art of the language. Poetry was a big deal. Stories and storytelling, very important in the Muslim culture. So they brought that to the Jews. Getting back to our historic... Well, let me just say just a few things here. So words, very important, and that's what brought us poetry. That's what brought poetry into the Jews. We didn't really have a lot of poetry before the golden age of the Muslim-Jewish interrelationship. The strong Jewish poems were written in Arabic and Hebrew at this time, or during these several hundred years, where we were under Muslim influence. So poetry became important, and the piyutim, some of the poems that are in the Siddur and in some other places in our liturgy, came from this time. So that influence of the Muslims and Muslim use of language came into the Jews. And we dealt more with language and the beauty of language and making language work for us, not just to convey an idea, but to be a beautiful conveyance. That came from the Muslims. I misspelled it, piyutim. Did I spell it right? P-U-T-M. Yeah, it could be spelled that way. P-U-T is singular. P-U-T-M is plural. That's the Hebrew word for a poem, a liturgical poem. So that's why I wrote words, poetry, P-U-T-M here. Another contribution of the Muslims, which is extremely important, is Arabic numerals. Until that time, we were using Roman numerals and Hebrew letters for numbers. You can't do math with numbers like that, right? So if you want to just do simple math, you need a different system. They created the different system. They created the number system that we have today, then, so that we can do multiplication and long division and algebra, and algebra is an Arabic word, right? So math increased under them because they came up with Arabic numerals. So that's an important contribution of the Muslims. And then, as an outgrowth of the words, poetry, and piyutim, was philosophy. If you like words, and you like to use a lot of them, and you live in a Muslim country where you sit around smoking a water pipe, which either has, like today, just a hookah, and you're smoking whatever regular tobacco, flavored tobacco, or a little hashish mixed in. So all those words and the smoking and the sitting come together and make a lot of philosophy. So philosophy and discussion of philosophy was a thing. It's kind of like being in the village smoking a clove cigarette and having a cappuccino, right? You're just like, you're talking philosophy and the world and philosophy. That was also very important in that world. And so that's where our first books of philosophy also appear on the scene. We don't have philosophic treatises. Is that the plural? There are no Jewish philosophic treatises until that time. So it was also in response, as we'll see, to something that came up at that time, but it was because of the culture of language and how it was used and the discussion of philosophy that was in the air. So the Jews were influenced by that. okay. Moving back to our timeline, basically. So we are post-Talmudic in the era of the bulk of the Jews and all of the major scholarship being in Babylon, right, in Baghdad, in cities near Baghdad, Sura and Pampadisa, two main cities where there are two major yeshiva academies in those two cities. That's where the top Jewish scholarship was. Secondary Jewish scholarship was in the land of Israel. And there wasn't even tertiary Jewish scholarship at the time. There was very little Jewish thinking going on independently outside of those two main communities. There were Jewish communities that had already begun to sprout all around the world, some because of trade, as we discussed before. Another reason why Jews started to leave Babylon was because of, and this is just important to put in as a piece, because of what was the religion in Babylon before Islam? Does anybody know? Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism, which there is a remnant still of Zoroastrians in the world today, but that was the dominant religion in Persia at the time. The Zoroastrians believe in two gods, and I think that's probably where the Christian concept, that in some Christian groups, where they have a very strong concept of God and an equally strong concept of Satan. And the concept of buying souls, you know, you sell your soul to the devil. What does that come from? But that comes from, and this is not all Christianity, but a group of Christianity, a subset, where they believe that God and Satan are locked in battle. Who will win? The one that gets more souls. So you can either give your soul to God, or the devil wants your soul. He wants your soul because he is fed by your life energy. So he wants to buy your soul to strengthen him. So he'll give you anything in this world so that he can have your soul. Right? So there's these two powers, the good and the evil, fighting against each other with humanity caught in the middle. So that is not all, but a partial Christian concept. Some Christians believe in that God-devil thing. Right? I mean, other Christians believe in the devil, but not quite as strong. But I think that probably has its roots in Zoroastrianism, which believed in a god of light and a god of dark, two equal powers that struggled for dominion in the world, and you had to pay, according to their philosophy, what's the word, obeisance, you had to pay both to be able to live. You had to have allegiance to both gods. So Jews have a problem with Zoroastrianism. We believe God is one, right? So did you ever notice in the Siddur that there's two Shemas, right, in the morning service? There's a first Shema pretty much right away. Morning blessings, sacrifice of Isaac, right around there is the first Shema. Just the Shema. In some Siddurs, it's just the Shema and the Baruch Shem Kavod Mochatul Yilam Ba'ed sentence. In other Siddurs, it's the Shema Baruch Shem Kavod in the first paragraph. And then you go through the whole Psukei Dezimra, all the Psalms, and then the blessings, and then the main Shema, all three paragraphs, right? What's with the first Shema, right? It's a mitzvah to say the Shema in the morning and in the evening, about twice in the morning. That comes from Zoroastrian repression, where the Zoroastrians forbade the saying of the Shema, because our mantra is against their religion. So, and they posted guards outside our synagogues to hear if we were going to say it or not. So we snuck one in early before the guards would get there, so that in case they got there, we already said it. And we could skip that part in the service. But you want to make sure it's at least said before anybody says you can't say it. So, and that remains state. We still have that. So that's from Zoroastrian repression. It was pretty okay living with the Zoroastrians, largely worked out pretty well, until around the end of the 600s-ish, when the repression got very strong. A new caliph arose, or whatever he was called at the time, new pasha, and he outlawed the keeping of the Sabbath. And was working on making that manifest so that people really couldn't when he died by the grace of God. So, and then his son took over. His son was no better. But what happened pretty much in the middle of his son's reign, approximately, was the Muslims got to Persia. That was a big relief for the Jews, because it did pick up the burden of the Zoroastrian repression that was falling heavier on them. So part of the burden was that some of the Jews left for other lands. So in addition to trade, one way Jews got to other places was to leave because of repression and oppression. So Zoroastrian repression was one reason why Jews went to other places and established communities in Europe and in Northern Africa. And it was also, that repression also made it so that the Jews actually welcomed the coming of the Muslims. Because they were people who believed in one God. Their whole message was one God is good, we should talk about one God, there should be one God. Make these people who didn't believe in one God believe in one God. The Jews were happy with that. They didn't know, you know, what was coming, but they're happy with the beginning of that. So that's in about 700, early 700s, where the Muslims come to Persia and take over. So now we still have the center of the Jews in Babylon, in and around Baghdad, the second center in Israel, and still functioning that way. So we basically have, unlike today, centralized authority. And so basically there is a central place from which Jewish interpretation flows. All the other small communities all around the world did not have their own academies. So while they did have rabbis and pastoral caregivers, they didn't have halachic decisors. So anybody who needed to know something big sent a letter to Babylon. And those letters were answered and sent back. So we have extensive correspondence from that time of how the halacha developed and was answered to those communities. So that's a very important primary source for us in understanding the development of halacha and the relationship between that community and the outlying communities. But basically, it was centralized then. So, excuse me, the structure there was a double structure. The structure of leadership there was the double structure of the Reish Galusa and the Gaon. Galut, or Gullus, right, as we say in English, Gullus is exile. You're in exile, right? So if you're not in Israel, you're in exile. So Babylon is exile. It's Gullus. They spoke Aramaic there. That's where the Jews spoke Aramaic from, I think it's during Second Temple times and straight through until about 700, the Jews spoke Aramaic. So instead of Galus, it was Galusa. Because at the end is an Aramaic ending, like Ima and Abba. In Hebrew, it's Av Ve'im, like Kvod Av Ve'im, honor your mother and your father. But it's hold over from the Aramaic. When we spoke Aramaic, we have the words Ima and Abba, with Alephs at the end. A word that ends in Aleph that sounds like a Hey ending is usually of Aramaic extraction rather than Hebrew extraction. Anyway, so the Jews are speaking Aramaic. They are in Gullus, except for that's the head of the, so they have somebody who's in charge, right? So the temporal head is the Rosh, head of Rosh Galus, the Rosh Galusa. That's what he's called. He's in charge of all temporal affairs. And the one who's in charge of all religious affairs is the head of the academy, the head of the yeshiva. So at that time, he's not called the Rosh Yeshiva, he's called the Gaon, which means genius. But that was the official title of the head of the academy at the time, was the Gaon. Now, they had two academies, two main academies, one in Sura and one in Pampatisa, so they both had heads. So there was, often there was agreement over which head was the Gaon, so that there was the two heads, the temporal head and the spiritual head of the community. And sometimes there was disagreement and parity between the two Gaon, so that there was a fight between them, so now there were three heads, right? Three heads, of course, were a problem. Two heads were also a problem. Even if it was just the Reish Galusa and the Gaon, they still would fight over what exactly falls into the realm of temporal and what falls into the realm of spiritual, who's in charge of what, and there were arguments about that, too. Oh, my gosh. The clock goes way too fast. I'm going to have to get here earlier to nudge him out faster so I get more time. No, but some people have to get their kids, their parents.
That too.
Right, that too. To get the people who they're in charge of caring for. I did print out three copies of Rabbi Sadia Gaon's Emunot V'Deyot article on Wikipedia. So anybody who wants three, there's three of those if you want to look at it. Maybe you can take it. Because I just want to mention Sadia Gaon here. What's the story? Oh, I have four copies. Good. Okay, you can take that home and read it for our homework. Or you can look up on Wikipedia and find it yourself. So I'll just end for today on the fact that one of the major Gaons of the time, a shining light in the Gaonate, was Rabbi Sadia Gaon. Sadia Gaon was a major force, young, prolific writer, and he writes in Arabic. So he's one of the first ones to write books of philosophy, but also to write in Arabic because the tide has changed. He was born in Egypt in 1882, dies in Baghdad in 942. So already the Muslims had been in charge of Persia for a couple hundred years when he comes. So the Jews are now speaking Arabic, no longer Aramaic. The Muslim culture is really, especially because there's more interchange between the two. If you remember back from a million years ago when we talked about the first exile, the destruction of the first temple when the Jews went into Babylon, they did not assimilate there because, remember, the Gemara says the Babylonians were like hairy bears. They were boors. They were coarse people without good manners, without an intellectual culture. And the Jews were not attracted like they were very attracted to the Greeks, who were much more refined and had a sense of beauty and aesthetic and an intellectual tradition. So there was no assimilation, really, with the Persians at that time. But now, so you would imagine also at this time, so the Jews are still living like that, not integrating with the culture, not taking on their language. But now with the Muslims coming in and Muslim culture coming in and the beauty of language coming in and a one God concept and bringing some refinement to the Gentiles of that area, Now there was much more interplay. And now the language, the everyday language of the Jew, became Arabic, not Aramaic. And so Rabbi Sadia Gaon is, in that time, is the first Gaon that's not homegrown. He was not educated in the academies of Babylon. Rather, he's from Egypt. And he was chosen from Egypt to help solve a dispute between the two Gaons there. And he was clearly more brilliant. In addition to the fact that he wrote against the Karaites, a strong movement of the time, which we'll have to start up with next time, because that's an important thing to see. But he writes a lot about them. And he also writes this book that I gave you that I hand out for, Emunot Vedeo. It's the first treatise on Jewish philosophy. And what's interesting about this treatise, in addition to the fact that it was written in Arabic, is that it is not written in the Aristotelian paradigm that Maimonides writes. For instance, Maimonides' The Guide to Perplexed was also a treatise on the philosophy of the Jews, but written to people who are thinking Aristotle and Aristotelian philosophy. So he writes to that mindset of where he is in Spain. But this is written to the mindset of really more the Muslim philosopher and what's being discussed at that time. So it's a different type of philosophy. So this is a book that still would speak to us today. You don't have to first understand Aristotle to understand the philosophy. This speaks more to us. So this is just key points from the book. But that's one of the big contributions of Sadia HaGaon. And we'll pick up with Sadia and the Karaites next time. Jewish. It's Jewish. It's yeah. I'm not sure that.
Mixture of what? Hebrew and.
It's. How did Aramaic develop? That's an excellent question. I'm not quite sure. It's not a mixture of another language. It's a Semitic language. That's like saying Arabic is a mixture of Hebrew and even. Arabic shares roots with Hebrew. You know, wahad is one in Arabic and echad in Hebrew, so they sound similar, but they're not. They're not branches of each other.
When the temple stood, Jewish people spoke Hebrew.
Aramaic.
So when Hebrew emerged,
as a spoken language. So I think it may have been spoken, I'm not sure if it was spoken in first temple times, but it wasn't, again, a spoken language. From whenever they spoke it, if they spoke it coming out of Egypt, and then until the establishment, but whenever it ended at that time, it was not spoken again until the modern state of Israel. As a spoken everyday language. It's possible, because now I'm just thinking, I think Aramaic possibly emerged as a, in a way, like a dialect that developed, because Hebrew is so holy. Why would you want to talk about laundry and business in the holy tongue? Mm-hmm. You need something that's understandable, but to the side of it. I think that's how it develops, that it's not, so that there would be a secular Jewish language. So that you wouldn't be speaking the holy language for mundane things.
Oh, so that's, okay.
Yeah, I think that's how it emerged. So, but it's not somebody else's language, it's our language. There's still a few people who speak Aramaic, Christians in Syria, I think, in Lebanon, little pockets who speak Aramaic today, who are related to early Christians.
But the Jews?
Well, the Jews do not. No, we took on languages of the countries. We Judaicized many of the languages of the countries that we went to. So there's a Judeo-Arabic. Just like today, there's a Judeo-English. You hear the rabbis talking, you know, or if you go to my shul and you hear them give the Dvar Torah, it's in a language you can't, it's in English. It's hard to understand.
Yeah.
It's a Judeo-English. So we did Judeo-Spanish and Judeo-Arabic, and that's what Judeo-German is, Yiddish.
Yiddish,
right?
Ladino.
So Judeo-Spanish is Ladino, and Judeo-Arabic I don't think has its own name. It's just Judeo-Arabic. But we Judaicize the language of the country that we're in or the language that's around us. We make it into a Jewish language. Sadia? No, I just did
so
four. I wasn't sure if people would be interested or not. So
okay.
You can look it up on Wikipedia.
All right,
I thought, yeah. But you can borrow this if you want. Do you want to borrow the Quran?
No.